Thank you for tuning in. It's time for this week's episode of History's Hook with your host, Tom Price. Take it away, Tom.
Welcome to History's Hook, where I guarantee that we'll get you hooked on history. I'm your host, Tom Price. Each week on History's Hook, we'll be bringing you interesting and informative stories from the past in an effort to connect the history in our own backyard to the big events that compose national and world history. We'll explore a new topic every week and bring in experts and eyewitnesses to the events, places, and people we'll be talking about. This is not your high school history class. We're going to make history fun and compelling. We're going to get you hooked. The song you just heard was a song called James K. Polk by the band They Might Be Giants, and it's helping us kick off an important three-part series as we explore the lives of Tennessee's three presidents, Andrew Jackson, James K. Polk, and Andrew Johnson. It's interesting to note that none of those three men were actually born in Tennessee, but each spent the majority of their lives in the state and ascended to the White House while calling Tennessee home. Each of the three had an enormous impact upon Tennessee and United States history over a time frame that spans over 40 years, Jackson being elected in 1828 and Andrew Johnson ending his term in 1869. Of course, their contributions have been felt far beyond their presidential terms, and many of their policies are still relevant to this day. All of them have been in the news lately. It is also interesting to note that Murray County, Tennessee was, in a way, a crossroads in their lives. Each of them spent time here, and the subject of today's program, James K. Polk, considered Murray County to be his home. I'm joined today in the studio by my co-host, Dr. Barry Gidcombe, along with the longtime director of the President James K. Polk Home and Museum, John Holtzapfel. Good morning to you both.
Good morning, Tom.
Good morning.
John, tell us a little bit about the James K. Polk Home and Museum. How did it begin?
The house is the only surviving home of James K. Polk other than the White House. And that's really what put it on the map. As you certainly know, Tom, and you know, Barry, James K. Polk retired and died in a big home in downtown Nashville that was supposed to be his museum. In fact, in his will, he stipulated that after he and his wife, Sarah, passed away, that Nashville home would go to the state of Tennessee as a museum and monument. And a complicated situation involving wills and family disputes. In 1901, that house was torn down. Even before that, the gravesite and the yard had been moved. And some very distraught family members who wanted James K. Polk's legacy to continue were looking for a new home for that. Polk wanted his museum to be in a house where he lived, and the house in Columbia was the only surviving one other than the White House. So it's been since 1929 that Columbia, Tennessee has had a presidential museum.
Right, which is pretty amazing. I think something that we often take for granted living here in Columbia, that this is a presidential town. And I've had the privilege to work at the Polk Home for 21 years. I think there are several great strengths. One is the staff. You're going to get one of the best tours you're going to find anywhere in the country when you go through the Polk Home. The other is the collection. Tell us a little bit about the collection.
Yes, absolutely. And Tom, as your listeners may or may not know, was the curator of the Polk Home for over 21 years, responsible for the collections. Right now, his successor, Candace Candido, doing a great job for us. But yes, it's things from throughout his lifetime, not just from his years in Columbia, but a lot of White House things, things from the big home, that home in Nashville where he retired and died. So everything from documents to major pieces of furniture are in our collections here.
It's some wonderful objects to see, some one-of-a-kind objects, things that you'll never see anywhere else in the world. So it's a great historic site. John, how long have you been there?
Over 35 years now. So,
which is amazing. In the museum field, just for those of you who are not or have never worked in the museum field, one of the benefits of working at a museum is going from museum to museum, maybe having a career that spans three or four different historic sites. But John, you've chosen to remain at Polk for a very long time. What's the thing that's kept you there all this time?
I'm learning things all the time. I mean, we're a small enough site that I'll still help with tours even as an administrator. And Wow, almost every week I could get a question I've never heard any time before.
After all of this time.
After all this time.
Let me ask you this. What about James K. Polk intrigues you? What can you think of one thing that really is kind of the hook for you when you think about James K. Polk?
Certainly the fact that he accomplished so much, really shaped the country geographically, also sort of shaped the presidency and the way he exercised his executive power. Yet he is still in some way seen as an obscure president. The average American might not know who James K. Polk is. So that contrast and sort of the pleasure of having visitors discover how much James K. Polk accomplished, I think, is something that's wonderful about working at the Polk.
People are almost always pleasantly surprised when they come to the Polk because they don't know a lot about him going into it, and the number of accomplishments that he managed to get done in a single term of office, everybody's always amazed. So it's absolutely a fun part of the job. That leads into the next question that most historians consider him to be one of the most successful, perhaps the most successful one-term president in American history, yet he's one of the least known. Why is that?
Certainly here in Tennessee, he's overshadowed by Andrew Jackson, who is the more colorful, or had the more colorful personality. I mean, Jackson, the war hero, the duelist, the man who sort of shapes the Democratic Party, old Hickory compared to James K. Polk's young Hickory. So James K. Polk was sort of in Andrew Jackson's shadows during his lifetime, and I think still is. That certainly plays a big role. Also, much of what Polk did was controversial. I mentioned all the land he added. He almost came to blows with Great Britain over the Oregon Territory. There was a controversial war against Mexico during his presidency with the annexation of the Southwest. And then after all that land was acquired, there was immediate question of whether you allow slavery in all this Western territory. So the controversy over what many saw as an unnecessary war, and certainly the slavery controversy, make Polk's accomplishments less celebrated.
Right. We're going to get into all of those topics a little bit later in the interview. I mentioned in the opening that all three of Tennessee's presidents have been in the news lately. Interesting. President Trump has publicly likened himself or tries to model himself after the best known of the Tennessee presidents, Andrew Jackson. Some writers and historians have argued, however, that perhaps Trump is a little bit more like James K. Polk. In his book, The Year of Decision, 1846, the historian Bernard DeVoto described Polk as rigid, narrow, obstinate, far from first rate. More than that, the man himself was pompous, suspicious, secretive, had no humor, he could be vindictive, and he saw spooks and villains around him. So I think those are similar descriptions that have been used for our current president. DeVoto continues, however, and this is a quote, "But if his mind was narrow, it was also powerful, and he had guts. His integrity was absolute, and he could not be scared, manipulated, or brought to heel. No one bluffed him. No one moved him with direct or oblique pressure. Furthermore, he knew how to get things done, which is the first necessity of government, and he knew what he wanted done, which is the second." Time will tell whether President Trump can live up to a comparison like the latter half of that description. Do you see any other similarities between Trump and Polk?
Wow. I think I've been at the Polk home so long that I'm living in the 1840s and do not give a good perspective of comparing James K. Polk with present day politicians.
Right. Well, that it's a sticky wicket. I think that's sometimes a difficult thing. I saw a couple things. One is maybe the work ethic. I think both of them are considered workaholics. Talk a little bit about Polk's work ethic.
Wow, that's to an extreme. A workaholic is a good way of describing it. He had an unpromising youth. He was in bad health for much of his earlier years, and really for his whole life. And some historians have seen his hard work as a way of sort of compensating. I mean, Polk was friends and contemporaries with people like Andrew Jackson, David Crockett, Sam Houston, and Polk doesn't fit that rugged frontier image. He was a man who got a lot accomplished first as a student by studying hard, as a lawyer by constantly outworking his opponents, and as a politician by staying so focused on his work.
Maybe one more comparison as I was thinking about this, clashes with the cabinet. Now, James K. Polk didn't lose cabinet members. I think out of all of his cabinet, one left, but the rest remained. But in his diary, you find that he wasn't afraid to go against their counsel and make his own decision.
Oh, very much that's true. Polk himself used the phrase, "I will myself be president," and that was even in regard to Andrew Jackson. We mentioned how much he sort of looked up to Jackson. Shortly before Polk's presidency, while he was still here in Columbia, he was trying to decide or select his cabinet. And he actually paid a visit to the Hermitage to ask Jackson's advice on whom he should select for the cabinet. And he didn't follow the advice. But he still made that courtesy call. But right there from the very beginning, he was even going to defy Andrew Jackson's suggestions.
I think the comparisons, we can end with the comparisons with our current president there, other than saying here's sort of opposite ends of the spectrum where Trump comes from a great deal of wealth. Polk didn't. Where did James K. Polk find his beginnings?
Here in Murray County, and I know you always want to make that hook or connection between Murray County history and national history, and really, when James Polk came here, this was the West. This was the frontier.
So he was born in?
In North Carolina, near Charlotte. Okay. His father, Samuel, was a land surveyor who always wanted to stay near the edge of the frontier, and then also was paid partly in land. So Samuel eventually made the decision to move his family to where his work and his land were. And James K. Polk was 10, going on 11, when the family crossed the mountains and settled here in Middle Tennessee. And it really was, the first year here at least, was really barely subsistence living. So James K. Polk did have that frontier experience, and that would really shape his life and certainly shape his political philosophy.
So his father, Samuel, was a land surveyor, a land speculator. What about his mother?
The mother, Jane, was a dutiful wife and mother who had 10 children, who'd outlive 7 of the 10 children. So a very strong woman in her own right, a strong, resolute woman.
And a Presbyterian?
Definitely, a strict Presbyterian.
Her maiden name was
Knox. As in John Knox, the Scottish Presbyterian reformer.
And James
She's the descendant of John Knox's brother, in fact.
Right. So James K. Polk was the oldest in
the
a family.
Oldest of, and has Knox as a middle name. Yeah. That's what that K stands for.
And so he has 9 siblings. He's the oldest of 10 in this frontier family. He's about 10 or 11 years old when he comes from North Carolina to Tennessee. And they settle in Murray County, right, in the north end of town. And so what is it like for him? Do we have any sense of what his youth was like growing up on the western frontier?
There's very little specific documentation on it, but a noted historian, Charles Sellers, in his biography of James K. Polk, sort of speculates on what life on the frontier would have been like. And Sellers is one who does pick up on the theme that Polk wasn't in good health compared with many of the others. So right from the beginning, might have seen himself as inferior, almost. Didn't have really any formal education until about 17 years old. In fact, shortly before that, as a teenager, right before his 17th birthday, he needed surgery for stones in his urinary bladder. And it's sort of a gruesome story to be hearing early in the morning, so I won't go into too many details, but he had to travel over 230 miles by horseback to Danville, Kentucky, near Lexington, just to get to Dr. Ephraim McDowell, the nearest surgeon who could perform the operation. Polk had the operation while awake. It was successful, but really took a toll on him physically. There looked like no way he could follow in his father's path of being a land surveyor, which is really rigorous. I mean, constant horseback riding and hiking off the beaten trail. And Polk himself needed to just focus on his studies to succeed in life.
So at 17 years old, he has this surgery. He recovers. He's more robust after that?
Somewhat, but still not what you'd consider really the healthy frontier youth even then.
So he goes to his education with a vengeance.
Yes, and briefly attended sort of the forerunner of what's now Zion Christian Academy outside of Columbia. then a short time at Bradley Academy in Murfreesboro, but had less than 3 full years of formal education before he applied for University of North Carolina and did so well on his entrance exam, he was admitted to college as a sophomore and then graduated in 3 years with top honors.
Which is pretty incredible to think about. So he grows up on the frontier, doesn't really have any formal education, really because he can't, until he's 17 years old, and then within a few years graduates from the University of North Carolina, which is one of the finest men's schools in the South in the 19th century, right at the top of his class. And that's, I think, where we first see that work ethic coming into play. If I remember from my reading, his roommate in college talked about his work ethic and how he would stay up all night studying a subject until he knew everything about it, and then succeeded in that way.
And that roommate was no slouch. His name was William Moseley, and he was the first governor of Florida.
Right.
Yeah, Florida became a state the day before Polk was inaugurated. So interesting little trivia there. One day, one of the roommates becomes the governor of a brand new state. The next day, the other roommate becomes president of the United States.
Incredible. Well, we're going to take our first break. We'll be back in a few minutes to talk more about James K. Polk. We'll be right back right after these messages.
Don't go away. History's Hook with your host, Tom Price, will be right back after this brief commercial break.
At Columbia Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram Fiat, you can always count on us for a great selection of late model, low mileage, one owner vehicles. All have been thoroughly inspected and are ready to go. You can even save time and buy online with our online shopping tool. Looking to sell your vehicle? Great news! We're paying top dollar for your trade. All makes, all models, and in any condition. Trade in and trade up today. At Columbia Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram Fiat, you can count on us.
Hello, this is Rick Tillis from Tillis Jewelry. What is a full-service jeweler? Experienced staff, custom designers, in-house jewelry repairs, and beautiful jewelry. Yes, at Tillis Jewelry, we are passionate, knowledgeable, and committed to integrity. We strive to be the best in our community and in our profession. We build long-term relationships and become part of family traditions that will cross generations. We delight clients by providing an unparalleled selection, superior service, and exceptional value. Tillis Jewelry, we exceed your expectations.
American Standard Heating and Air Conditioning is built to a higher standard, so you can focus on the problems in your life that actually matter, like the stair that only creaks when everyone else in the house is asleep. American Standard Heating and Air Conditioning, built to a higher standard.
Call Davis Heating and Cooling at 931-388-2090 for all your home comfort needs. Davis Heating and Cooling is your local American Standard dealer and proudly serves the Maury County area. Find Davis Heating and Cooling online and on Facebook or call today, 388-2090.
Are you thinking about a new fence? Maybe you need a pole barn. Then you should give Sands Fence Company a call. That's 931-309-1644. Will Sands has built his business based on the principles of honesty, quality, and integrity. Sands Fence Company has been in business for over 20 years, providing the community with farm, residential, and commercial fencing, as well as pole barns and buildings. Call today for a free estimate. Sands Fence Company, 931-309-1644. 931-309-1644.
This is Dr. Dominic Mancini from the Dr. Gill Center. Have you been injured in a car accident? Are you still in pain? Untreated whiplash injuries to the spine may lead to future conditions, such as neck pain, low back pain, and headaches. The doctors at the Dr. Gill Center specialize in detecting and treating these conditions before they get worse. Our accident consultations are free. Call me, painfree.com, or call 615-551-9224.
Debbie Matthews grew up and lives in beautiful Columbia, Tennessee. As a realtor, she is well-versed in homes, neighborhoods, development, and schools. She wants to share her love of her home state with others to help them find just the right place to raise a family, open a business, or develop a dream. From luxury listings to land, she can handle it all. She is the current leading producer, Nashville Realty Group. Contact Debbie Matthews Realtor at 615-476-3224. That's 615-476-3224.
We all live very busy lives. Sometimes we just need a break. Wouldn't it be nice to have an extra pair of hands to help out? Let me introduce you to New Dawn Cleaning Service. No job is too big or too small because they do it all, from residential to commercial. They offer standard cleaning, construction cleaning, carpet shampooing, and window cleaning. Whether you are looking for a one-time service or regular scheduled cleaning plan, New Dawn is ready to help. With years of experience, you can relax, kick back, and call New Dawn Cleaning Service at 615-977-6901.
History's Hook with your host, Tom Price, is back. Take it away, Tom.
Welcome back to History's Hook. Today we're talking about James K. Polk. We have in the studio with us John Holzapfel, the director of the James K. Polk Museum here in Columbia, Tennessee. John, we were just talking about James K. Polk's education, that he, at the age of 17, really begins his education. Within 3 years, he's admitted to the University of North Carolina, graduates in 3 years rather than four, at the top of his class. He then comes back to Tennessee. And what's next for him? What's his chosen career path?
Okay, while he was in college, he participated in a debating society called the Dialectic Society. And historians think that that's where he developed his interest in law and politics. And coming back to Columbia, he was determined to become a lawyer. Nothing like law school here on the frontier, though. So he became an apprentice to a well-known Nashville lawyer and politician, Felix Grundy. And we've talked about Andrew Jackson being a mentor to James Polk, but certainly Felix Grundy was too. Polk would serve in Grundy's office and probably do things like copy documents and maybe even light the fire on cold winter days. In exchange for that, he was trained in the law.
He got to read the law is the exactly. term that they often used, which is quite literally reading every law book that they could get mm-hmm. their hands on. They still had to pass the bar exam, however.
Yes, which Polk did, and already had a law practice in Columbia by age 25.
So his mentors were really political giants in the time period, and we'll talk about this when we get to the Jackson Show a little bit more, but there's a real shift in political thought that happens around the era of Jackson, where prior to Andrew Jackson, all of the previous presidents were either the New England elite or they were from Virginia. So when Jackson gets elected, politics sort of moves westward, this idea of common man, and you have people like Andrew Jackson and Sam Houston and Felix Grundy, who at the height of his career would be Attorney General in President Van Buren's cabinet. So he's really learning not just the law and politics, he's learning from the political minds of the mid-19th century.
Absolutely. Grundy was actually U.S. Attorney General during Martin Van Buren's presidency, so Polk is learning from major national figures.
What kind of a lawyer was he? Do we have any sense? What kind of cases did he... Was he a defense attorney or a prosecuting attorney?
A little bit of everything. We know he was a defense attorney, handled or defended accused horse thieves, counterfeiters, an accused stalker. But also did a lot of land cases. And in the frontier, there's so many land disputes, people fighting over borders. And this son of a land surveyor, James K. Polk, handled cases for his father on occasion and also handled a lot of other land cases, too.
He had plenty of business on the frontier. He didn't remain in his law practice very long before he jumped into a political career. How did that begin?
As a lawyer, he was a circuit lawyer. He was based here in Columbia, but he traveled from one county seat to the next throughout the frontier. And as a result, he became well known over a wide area. And we think that sort of fueled his political interests. But the fact he did look up to people like Felix Grundy and Andrew Jackson, who made the transition from law to politics, might have inspired James Polk anyway. But yes, he was just in his 20s when he challenged an incumbent for a seat in the state legislature and won.
So how many terms in the state legislature?
Okay, he was just one term as a legislator, but was already looking ahead to national politics. In fact, in between his state election and, well, he got married, I should say, after that. He married Sarah Childress of Murfreesboro, whom he courted while he was in Murfreesboro as a state legislator. Murfreesboro was Tennessee's temporary capital at that time. With Sarah's input, too, we get the impression he started looking for higher office. And after only one term in Tennessee politics, so to speak, in the Tennessee legislature. He ran for Congress and U.S. Congress and won and served 7 terms as U.S. Congressman, including 2 terms as Speaker of the House.
I'm glad you brought up Sarah. She's a big piece of this puzzle, I think. Now, the Pokes had no children.
Maybe a side effect of that crude surgery Polk had as a teenager.
So tell us a little bit about Sarah and her role as the wife of a congressman and later president of the United States. What do we know about Sarah?
From the very beginning, she had political interests. So for someone so focused on his career as James K. Polk, it was an ideal match. She shared his general political philosophy, the sort of populist democratic philosophy. She was an educated woman and not afraid to speak her mind. So she, throughout his life, served as sort of a behind-the-scenes advisor. She was a sounding board for his ideas. When he went off campaigning somewhere, like as a congressman, when he was campaigning, she served as his political eyes and ears at home, constantly corresponding with him about politics. And I know you will remember all your research and going through James K. Polk's published correspondence. The letters from Sarah to James will have a little bit about, take care of yourself, I hope you stay healthy, but much of it is just political matters.
Right. It's kind of all business all the time. From a political perspective, they're kind of a power team. We don't get any real sense of that personal connection between the two of them, but she's very much a political helpmate to James.
Yes, and when he was running for governor, she managed this schedule, and this really difficult schedule crisscrossing the state. And from her base here in Tennessee, she managed the campaign.
Which is pretty incredible for a woman in the 19th century who didn't have the right to vote, didn't have the right to run for office. We get a sense that she loves every bit of this. She's making a difference politically, even on a national scale, before she's even first lady. I think it's a fascinating match.
Yeah, she does 2 things. She manages the campaign and worries incessantly about her husband's health.
Right. That's that work ethic again. When you read the correspondence, when Polk was running for Congress, and even more so, and we'll get to this in a second, as he ran for governor, he rode on horseback to every county in the state, and people were writing about it in the newspapers, what this guy, this Herculean effort he would put into politics. And Sarah was sort of coordinating that, telling him where his opponent was speaking, and James K. Polk would at the last second ride up and enter a debate with his opponent. So I think she had a lot to do with his success in these state elections. So Polk is elected to Congress. He is one of President Andrew Jackson's chief lieutenants in the House of Representatives. What do we know about the relationship between Polk and Jackson from not just a political but a personal standpoint? Do we have any sense of that?
Both personally and politically, James K. Polk was very loyal. And Andrew Jackson certainly appreciated that. So jumping ahead in time, during James K. Polk's presidency, Andrew Johnson was a U.S. congressman and wasn't as loyal to Polk, didn't always agree with Polk's legislation the way Polk had with Jackson. And Polk actually made note of that Johnson wasn't as loyal to him as he had been to Andrew Jackson. But in truth, though, the loyalty wasn't hard because they were almost of one mind, that James K. Polk very much shared Jackson's populist belief in the common man and the looking after the interests of farmers and frontiersmen and factory workers.
So 7 terms in the House of Representatives, 14 years. Polk rose to the position of Speaker of the House. To this day, he is the only Speaker of the House to go on to become President of the United States. What kind of Speaker was he?
He was in some ways a beleaguered Speaker. In that he, as very Speakers of the House often are, they certainly take flack from the opposing party. And even within their own party, they're not always the most popular person because they have to do the necessary arm twisting to keep people in line. One of the issues that Polk as Speaker defended, was certainly controversial then and controversial in the history books, was the so-called gag rule of not allowing any discussion about slavery on the floor of Congress. That was such a divisive issue that we can't even talk about it. And Polk did his best to try to enforce that.
Polk was a very partisan politician. So like you're saying, I think every speaker is beleaguered in some manner because of that. But he was probably less willing to use a modern euphemism, cross the aisle in his time. So he was challenged to a duel on at least one occasion. I think Mr. Wise of Virginia called him out
and turned away from him. It's sort of interesting. At that time, it raised some eyebrows here that he turned away from a duel over what he thought was a trivial matter. But in the long run, it was actually to his benefit that during the 1844 Democratic campaign, or excuse me, the presidential campaign, the Whig candidate, Henry Clay, had been involved in some duels, and it actually became an issue that James K. Polk was this level-headed man who turned away from a frivolous duel, and Henry Clay was described as a bloodthirsty man attempting the lives or challenging the lives of his fellow man.
Yeah, I think what's interesting about that is that Henry Wise really wanted this duel. And I think Henry Wise thought he was going to kill James K. Polk. And Polk was very wise to not play into this. And it's interesting that Andrew Jackson, the duelist himself, Andrew Jackson heartily approved of the way Polk handled the situation.
Right, yeah. Wise was known to be a crack shot. This was absolutely an attempt at getting rid of the Speaker of the House. And Polk managed to get out of that. James K. Polk gives up his seat in the House of Representatives to run for governor of Tennessee. He's successful in his first try at it. What kind of a governor was he?
I'm actually going to hand that question over to Dr. Gitcomb, who recently gave a program in our Polk's America series, a series that you started, Tom, way back, I think, in 1998, of a monthly lecture series on American society and culture during Polk's presidency. And Barry did a really good program on James K. Polk as governor. So,
well, at the time that Polk was governor, the governor of Tennessee didn't really have a lot of authority. It was more of a ceremonial figurehead type position. But Polk himself had a lot more influence as governor simply because he had come back from Washington and rescued his party from the Whigs in 1839. Nevertheless, it was very hard to accomplish anything in his 2 years as governor, partly because of the panic of 1837 and the financial situation. And also the fact that Polk spent much of his time running for governor, or much of his time as governor, trying to get on the ticket as Van Buren's running mate.
Right, which the state of Tennessee, a lot of the citizens of the state of Tennessee didn't appreciate.
Right.
If I remember from newspaper articles, that he should be in Nashville doing his job rather than running around the state campaigning for Martin Van Buren. One term as governor, and then the bottom falls out. His career appears to be over. He loses two successive bids for re-election to governor of Tennessee. How did he react to the loss, and what did he do in the interim?
He worked and worked and worked and worked to try to revive his political career. You're absolutely right. He'd been a rising star up until this time. He had left the speakership really at the height of his power, almost as a favor for the Democratic Party in Tennessee. They were worried that the Whigs were gaining ascendancy in the state, so they needed a big name candidate to run for governor. As Barry mentioned, just the one-term governorship where he didn't do much, as governor itself, the position didn't allow him to do much. And he just was sort of there as the Whigs grew more and more powerful in Tennessee. But he did all he could in local or state Democratic politics and in national Democratic politics, too, to revive his career, constantly looking for opportunities. Polk was a hard worker, but he was also one who would seize on every opportunity. And when an opportunity came up, he was ready. And that's what happened in 1844.
Well, this is a good stopping point. We'll continue the story in 3 minutes and 30 seconds. You're listening to History's Hook.
Don't go away. History's Hook with your host, Tom Price, will be right back after this brief commercial break.
Hi, I'm Robert Rogers at Parks Motor Sales Buick GMC. Parks Motor Sales was founded by my granddad, Bobby Parks, and my great-granddad, Julian Mays, in 1958. We've been family-owned the whole time, and being family-owned, locally-owned, means you get to get your next vehicle or your existing vehicle serviced by the same people who stand in the grocery line with you, drop their kids off at the same school you do, and smile and are happy to see you when they do. So come see us at Parks Motor Sales in Columbia, Tennessee on 919 Nashville Highway or parksmotorsales.com.
I'm Barbara Lincoln with Holland's Pharmacy. We have advertised with WKRM and WKOM for the past several years and found it to be very successful. I highly recommend advertising with them if you have a local business like ours. We're located at 1608 Hatcher Lane here in Columbia. We're open Monday through Friday from 8 to 6 and Saturdays from 8 to 2. Stop by Holland's for all your prescription needs where we have fast, friendly, courteous service. We custom fit support hose for you also. Thanks for supporting Holland's and WKRM and WKOM.
Hi, I'm Steve, the garbage man. Are you new to Maury County? We want to welcome you and your family. We are a local residential garbage service, and we want to be your garbage man. We've been around for over 30 years, so we have a reputation. Check us out at garbagemaninc.com or call Mike at 931-540-0919. You could also ask your neighbor. 931-540-0919.
For 40 years, the Jewelers Bench has worked hard for their customers and provided the highest quality jewelry at the best price. They keep going back. Recent renovations have allowed them to expand their inventory. More high quality jewelry, custom vintage and estate pieces, and professional jewelry and watch repairs. They also buy gold. The Jewelers Bench, still here, still great service. 808 Trotwood Avenue, Columbia.
Every morning, I park my car across the street from my business, and I can't wait to get in there. That's pretty common for small business owners. We have the added satisfaction, however, of guiding hundreds of families with their retirement, education, savings, and general investments. We're a locally owned business that tries very hard to simplify a complicated world. This is Monty Sneed from Caledonian Financial in historic downtown Columbia.
Securities and investment advisory services offered through NBC Securities Incorporated, member FINRA and SIPC. Columbia Foodland is a locally owned and operated family grocery store with a full line of dry, dairy, frozen, meat, and produce items. We focus on keeping the freshest hand-cut meat and produce items daily with the most competitive prices in town. We offer weekly ad specials as well as in-store weekly specials throughout the store. Located at 427 West 7th Street in Columbia in the former Harris Foodland location. Columbia Foodland. We are here and ready to serve the wonderful people of Columbia and the surrounding areas. History's Hook with your host, Tom Price, is back. Take it away, Tom.
Welcome back to History's Hook. If you're just joining us, we're talking about James K. Polk today. We have in the studio Mr. John Holtzapple, the director of the James K. Polk Home and Museum, located here in Columbia, Tennessee. So just to recap, James K. Polk, a product of the Western frontier, goes to the University of North Carolina, becomes a lawyer, jumps immediately into politics on the state level, and then 14-year member of the United States House of Representatives, Speaker of the House, Governor of Tennessee, loses his bid, the next two bids for re-election. The bottom falls out. And you mentioned he goes back to what he knows, which is hard work. He's working in the interim. Did he have other sources of income, John, besides politics and the law?
Yes. And Polk, we talk about Polk and expansionist land is always a key to James K. Polk. His father, as a surveyor, was paid partly in land. James K. Polk would inherit land from his father and would invest in land. And here in the South, land, especially if you're farming land, often meant slavery, enslaved workers. And that was also part of James K. Polk's income. And I know about 8 years ago, you, Tom, were, as a curator, were working on an exhibit right this time of year. I remember the end of the year, during holiday time, you were working on an exhibit called A Matter of Utmost Caution, James K. Polk and Slavery. So I'm interested in your input on that.
Well, thanks for mentioning that. That was a big exhibit for us. So, right. So James K. Polk did engage in the institution of slavery. I thought he was a fascinating character from which to look at the institution of slavery, because he dealt with it from really two different perspectives. One, as a slaveholder himself, he inherited slaves from his father at the time of his marriage, at the time of his father's death, and continued to increase his slave holdings over time. Most of the enslaved people in of James K. Polk were sent to work on a plantation he owned in West Tennessee. I think he had two there, one in Fayette County, one in Hardeman County, I think. And then he sold that plantation, and the enslaved people there were moved into Mississippi, north central Mississippi, Yallabusha County, where he had 960 acres of land upon which the slaves worked and toiled. The other perspective from which James K. Polk was engaged in the idea of slavery is from a theoretical standpoint. As a politician in a time when slavery is really becoming a political issue, he's having to legislate on it. And you've already mentioned one of the ways that he dealt with slavery, certainly as Speaker of the House, was by not dealing with slavery. He invoked the gag rule and disallowed any discussion related to slavery over time. But one of the great fortunes, I often talk on this show about primary documents, going back to the documentation and how the Murray County Archives has all of the records. But Polk was an avid letter writer. He kept a diary, and those letters tell us a great deal about the slaves of James K. Polk. Because he was an absentee owner of this plantation in Mississippi, he had a series of overseers who ran the plantation, and they wrote to James K. Polk every month about what was happening on that plantation. So we have a very clear understanding of how the plantation was run. It gives us a very interesting view into plantation life and slave life in the mid-19th century. But Polk was making money on the plantation. I think he was, at least publicly or in his letters, trying to separate his plantation income from his political income. He was very aware, despite the fact that he invokes the gag rule, he's very aware of what slavery is starting to mean on a national scale and what that could mean to a politician as well. He continued to buy slaves even during his presidency, I think, but he did it through a third party. So again, publicly, people wouldn't know that the president was engaging in buying slaves. And there are abolitionist groups that are sort of gaining ground. Prior to Polk, I think they were kind of considered a fringe group, but by the time Polk is the president of the United States, it's becoming much more mainstream. And he's getting some angry letters, if I remember correctly, from some abolitionist groups in New England who were concerned about a slaveholding president in the White House. So he's keenly aware of what that means throughout his life. But we're fortunate, and at the Polk home, at least did our best and tried very much to sort of do that research and understand the lives of the enslaved people that belonged to James K. Polk. So let's get back to the politics a second, because this is where the story gets really interesting. He loses two bids for re-election for governor. He's at the lowest point in his career. Everybody thinks he's washed up. Mm-hmm. Except for James K. Polk. So what's his next move?
I said he was always one to seize opportunities. In 1844, heading into the Democratic Convention, it looked like the former president, Martin Van Buren, who had served one term and lost running for re-election, looked like Van Buren would be the Democrats' nominee that year, too. But not too long before the convention, he blundered in publicly revealing his concern about annexing Texas. And Texas had a long time been a Mexican province, which had broken away from Mexico in the 1830s. That was the rebellion with the Alamo and San Jacinto and all that. Now, a lot of folks in the United States wanted Texas to join the country. But Texas was a big chunk of slave territory. Mexico had never acknowledged Texas independence, and Van Buren, worried about stirring up the slavery issue and not wanting a war with Mexico, came out in opposition to annexing Texas. And that was a very unpopular position in the South and the West. And Tennessee qualifies as both the South and the West. So right away, James K. Polk, who had been a Van Buren loyalist, saw his candidate sort of going off in a dangerous direction as far as getting the nomination. Another prominent Democrat who had been on Jackson's cabinet, Lewis Cass from Michigan, was supporting Texas annexation. So the Democrats heading into their convention had Van Buren as their supposed but very weak front runner, Cass right on his heels, and a number of other candidates being mentioned. Polk, seeing a divided party, saw maybe an opportunity. And for a long time, historians would say that he saw just an opportunity of being vice president, that as a unifying figure, he was a good supporter and friend of Martin Van Buren, but he agreed with Cass on the Texas issue, so he could help sort of bridge the gap. Whoever got the nomination, Van Buren or Cass, would be looking for an olive branch for the other side, and Polk could fill that function. For a long time, that was the belief. But Polk's published correspondence is revealing that though Polk himself maybe still was thinking of the vice presidency, there he saw a path to something higher. He and his supporters saw that the division within the Democratic Party left an opening for him to revive his career. And though he lost here in Tennessee, he was still viewed favorably by the National Democratic Party. He had served as Speaker of the House. Again, he had stepped aside from his speakership out of loyalty to the Democratic Party. So, in a sense, the party owed him one.
I was going to say that Andrew Jackson was absolutely crushed at Van Buren's position on Texas and wrote him a letter, and he said, you know, I have shed tears of regret, but I can no longer support you for president. And with all the Southern delegates that looked to Andrew Jackson, that really opens the door for James K. Polk.
So he seizes the opportunity, and so he's considered our first dark horse candidate because he wasn't officially considered a candidate leading into the Democratic National Convention in Baltimore in 1844. His name comes up on the ballot at what point?
They actually went through seven ballots of Van Buren and Cass, and they've gotten more and more divided. Neither candidate was seizing the lead. Van Buren was actually gradually losing some support. The party was worried, party leaders were worried about the party just splitting in half, and they needed a compromise candidate.
Because they are going to be running their candidate against who?
Henry Clay.
Who is one of the greatest names, a household name in America in the time period, a giant in American politics.
Absolutely, and the Democrats were still hurting from losing the previous election with Martin Van Buren. So they needed a candidate to unite the party. It was on the eighth ballot that Polk's name first came up, and apparently it caused such a commotion and excitement and led to a lot of behind-the-scenes arm-twisting that he was nominated on the ninth ballot.
Unanimously.
Okay, yes.
Unanimously nominated on the ninth ballot. So at the lowest point in his political career, one of the greatest political turnarounds in American history, he winds up with a nomination for the presidency in 1844, running against Henry Clay, the great political giant of American politics. How does the election come out?
Polk was wise enough and aware enough of the slavery issue that he not only ran on Texas, but ran on the Oregon territory also. The theme, an expansionist platform, Texas and Oregon territory. And that refers to not just what's now the state of Oregon, but Washington, Oregon, Idaho, Western Montana, Canadian province of British Columbia, Western Alberta, all of that was considered the Oregon country. But it was a dispute over what was Great Britain's and what belonged to the United States. So Polk ran on seizing the Oregon territory and also getting Texas. And the expansion issue that would lead to a lot of trouble and lead to war as far as Texas went and Mexico, it was a very popular issue. Polk was riding the crest of a wave.
And he wins the election by about how many votes?
Wow. I don't remember that total. It was very close. It was New York was the decisive state. Had New York gone for Clay, Clay would have won the election. But I don't remember the
one
popular
of the closest yes. in the 19th century. Yeah. One of the closest in American history.
Do you remember, Barry?
Yes. In popular vote, Polk got 50% of the popular vote. Clay got a little over 48%. The wild card was the Liberty Party that picked up almost 2% of the popular vote, and the Liberty Party may well have cost Henry Clay the state of New York in the election, even though Polk had 170 electoral votes to Clay's 105. New York had 36 electoral votes, and the election really came down to who took New York, and Polk took New York by 5,000 votes over Clay. The anti-slavery, anti-Texas Liberty Party in New York picked up almost 16,000 votes.
Wow. Incredible. Incredible turnaround. So Polk is elected president of the United States. He's the youngest up to the time, just 49 years old, I think, when he becomes president. Pretty quickly says he's going to run for a single term only and then step aside. We're going to have to stop right here, take our final break, and then we're going to speed through his presidency when we come back. So we'll be right back right after these messages.
Don't go away. History's Hook with your host, Tom Price, will be right back after this brief commercial break. The Mules are back in town. Celebrate Mule Day's 50th anniversary, April 4th to 7th in downtown Columbia. All of your favorite Mule Day events are back. Jackpot mule races, log pulling, auctioneer's championship, Miss Mule Day pageant, the driving and gated mule shows, liars contest, and so much more. Don't miss the Mule Day parade, 11 a.m. Saturday, April 6th. Mule Day's 50th anniversary, April 4th through the 7th in downtown Columbia. Visit MuleDay.com for a complete schedule of events.
Hey, Tennessee, did you know that in the year 2022, more than 3,800 of your residents have lost their lives due to opioid overdose? Do your part to help lower these numbers by counting your medicine, locking it away, and disposing of it at a local medicine drop box location. You could also stop by your local health department and pick up a free medicine log box. This project is funded under a grant contract with the State of Tennessee Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services.
Hi, this is Maury County Mayor Sheila Butt, and I want to welcome you to one of the most fun and exciting weeks in Columbia in Maury County, known as the Mule Capital of the World. This year's Mule Day events have evolved from Breeders' Day, which was a one-day livestock show and mule marketing event in the 1840s. It has now become an almost week-long celebration that begins with a wagon train and includes craft shows, old-fashioned log pulling, bluegrass music, a nationally recognized state auctioneer contest, a liars contest, and a Mule Day parade on Saturday at 11. All of this and more is presided over by a lovely Mule Day queen and her court. In Maury County, we value our community traditions and faith, family, and freedom. We also have a strong team of people here pulling together. We're Team Maury, and we're glad you're here. Make yourself at home and enjoy the festivities with all of us.
History's Hook with your host, Tom Price, is back. Take it away, Tom.
Welcome back to History's Hook. Today we're talking about James K. Polk. So he is the youngest president elected up until the time, 49 years old. He had some pretty specific goals that he wanted to accomplish. What were they, John?
Enter the White House with four main goals, American expansion in the Southwest. And though he didn't specifically mention California, he had his eyes on all of that. Also, American expansion in the Northwest, the Oregon Territory, lowering tariffs and establishing what they called an independent U.S. Treasury, independent of the banking system.
Managed to accomplish them all in his single term of office.
In a single term. In fact, by 3 years into his term, he'd pretty much accomplished everything he set out to do, including stretching the country the whole way, the Pacific Ocean, settled the border of the Oregon Territory as the 49th parallel, so that we got Washington, Oregon, and Idaho.
Just through negotiations.
Just through negotiations. Sure enough, the Texas issue did lead to a very controversial war against
Mexico. The most controversial aspect of Polk's presidency is the U.S.-Mexican War, which had at its very base the settlement of the border between Texas and Mexico, being whether it was going to be the Nueces River or the Rio Grande. Polk sent a military detachment out to defend what he believed to be the southern border at the Rio Grande. Mexico sends a military unit up to defend the Nueces, and it's just a matter of time before there's a clash of arms.
Absolutely. War was inevitable. It was a two-year war, a very high casualty rate, mainly because of disease. That's a controversial war, in some ways a tragic war, but as far as Polk and getting his goals, a very successful war. United States got Texas to the Rio Grande, which not only was farther south than the Nueces, but went a lot farther west. I mean, stretched to present-day New Mexico and Colorado, too.
It's fascinating to me. It's one of those times in American history where a lot of people were against the war. That was the controversial side of it. Abraham Lincoln, who is a one-term congressman, came out against the war, lost his seat in Illinois as a result. Ulysses Grant was a young lieutenant in the war and fought there, and later in his life called it one of the most wicked chapters in American history. But what I find interesting about that is the circumstances of the war, controversial. Some call it negative, but the outcome, nobody is really complaining about. It's one of those odd times in American history where maybe bad deeds lead to a greater good, perhaps. That's continued to be debated even today.
Not only then did we get the land all with Rio Grande, but as part of the settlement, we were able to buy at a bargain rate, at a victor's rate, the Southwest, really the whole way to California. And then the same year the treaty was signed, 1848, gold was discovered in California. So, I mean, really salt in Mexico's wounds, but a huge advantage to the United States.
It's an amazing chapter in our country's history. And again, still debated out today of the rightness of that war. One of the key players, of course, in the U.S.-Mexican War is Zachary Taylor. James K. Polk, promised one-term president, did not seek re-election, as promised. And what happens in the next election?
The Whigs, who had been so critical of the Mexican War, ran a Mexican War hero as their candidate, Zachary Taylor, who had been fairly non-political up until that time. And Polk, really, throughout his presidency as a partisan Democrat, was kind of kicking himself that he was making heroes out of two Whigs, Zachary Taylor and Winfield Scott. He was worried they'd run for president. Both of them did, and Zachary Taylor won.
Wins the presidency. So James K. Polk retires from the presidency after his promised single term, 53 years old. What is his retirement like?
Instead of returning to Columbia, he decided to move to the big city in the area, Tennessee's capital city then of Nashville. But bad timing. There was shortly after he got back, there was a cholera outbreak in Nashville, and Polk died of cholera only 3 months after he left the White House, just 53 years old.
So he's the president to have the shortest retirement of all.
Absolutely.
I think the youngest president to die outside of those who have been assassinated.
Yes.
So lots of interesting statistics and factoids around James K. Polk. Various rankings of the president consider him one of the most successful in American history. Usually he ranks sort of in that second tier of successful presidents in American history. A lot to learn about James K. Polk. There are plenty of biographies out there about him. I would encourage our listeners to go to the Polk home. Go and visit the place where he lived. You're going to see an incredible collection. They have an amazing staff there that's going to tell you about the history and legacy of the 11th President of the United States. So go to the Polk home as soon as you get a chance. I want to close the show with a James K. Polk quote. And this is James K. Polk to a T. He said, "No president who performs his duties faithfully and conscientiously can have any leisure." And that's James K. Polk in a nutshell. He worked himself right to an early grave. On behalf of Dr. Barry Gidcombe, thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with another edition of History's Hook.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of History's Hook with your host, Tom Price. We hope you enjoyed today's show. Be sure to join us every Saturday at 9 a.m. and again at 6 p.m. right here on WKOM 101.7 FM for a journey through time.
Hey, y'all. This is Sergeant Brian Goetz with the Columbia Police Department. As a friendly reminder, the annual Mule Day Parade is Saturday, April 6th. Road closures will take effect from 7 a.m. to noon. Motorists traveling in Columbia that morning should expect delays around Garden and Carmack, West 7th, and Murray County Park. Follow our Facebook page at Columbia PDETN for the most up-to-date information.
Farmer Johnny here, Taylor Family Farm. I want to give you all a little look-see. We raise 100% non-GMO grass-fed beef, pasture chicken, and pork on our family farm. Everything that we grow is raised with love and care to ensure the highest quality and nutrition for our family and customers. You can shop online at TaylorFamilyFarmTN.com or visit our farm store in person at Etheridge, Tennessee at 301 Dave Reisner Road. That's TaylorFamilyFarmTN.com for more information.
Hello, my name is Connor Mims. My wife Bradley and I live in Columbia, Tennessee in Riverside. I'm a deck and porch builder, and my wife is a second grade teacher at Riverside Elementary. My specialty is designing and building elegant and comfortable porches and decks. Let me work with you to design and build the porch or deck of your dreams. Give us a call today from our website, MimsModernLandscape.com. That's MimsModernLandscape.com, and check out what we have to offer. Thanks.
Hello, my name is Zach Maddox. I'm a proud third-generation owner-operator of Columbia Paint and Wall Cover, founded by my grandfather, Ralph Maddox, in 1946. Now I am honored to continue the legacy as owner-operator today. We offer a variety of paint and wall covering products, but our passion is customer service. We can offer many personalized services and can come out to your house or business if needed. Visit us at our store downtown Columbia at 1114 Carmack Boulevard or online at paintcolumbia.com.
The Mules are back in town. For nearly 50 years, Mule Day funds have supported local schools, civic organizations, and improvements at the Maury County Park. Now Mule Day is working to positively impact the lives of young people in Maury County with the Mule Day Works Scholarship. Encourage young people to apply online at muleday.com/works or check it out to see how you can help support career and technical education in Maury County. Support Mule Day Works by attending Mule Day April 4th through the 7th. Visit muleday.com/works. That's muleday.com/works.
Hello everyone, it's Columbia Mayor Chaz Mulder here, inviting you to join us in celebrating one of Columbia's greatest traditions, Mule Day weekend on April 4th through the 7th. This long-standing event unites our community like no other, with mule shows, craft fairs, and of course, the Mule Day Parade on April 6th, starting at 11 a.m. Come one, come all, to Mule Day in Columbia, Tennessee, and let's make this year's celebration the best one yet. For event details, visit muleday.org. I'll see you at the parade.
This is Tripp Stoltz with Columbia Ace Hardware. I love listening to 101.7 WKOM FM, Columbia, Tennessee.